My ambition after that trip to the Highlands was simply to see if Tasmania could make a really good single malt whisky.
We don't expect everyone to like these wines, so yes, there's some risk.
Drink more sherry, because that's when you can really educate yourself on what happens in maturation.
The thing is with Australian natives, you put them in a gin, the aftertaste invariably is just bitter and unpalatable.
I think the Irish whisky landscape is going to be wildly different over the next 5 years.
This is the Drinks Adventures podcast. I'm James Atkinson, and this is the show where I speak to some of the world's most exciting producers of beer, wine and spirits, and uncover trends and issues in the drinks industry today.
Our guest this episode is Philip Moore, who in February 2022 became the first Australian inducted into the Gin Magazine's Hall of Fame. Now you might well ask, who is Philip Moore? He's certainly not one of our highest profile gin distillers. But Philip was actually the first Australian gin distiller to win gold at the International Wine and Spirits Competition, and his distilling career stretches back to the very early days of contemporary Australian gin. Prior to that, Philip studied and trained as a horticulturist and medical herbalist. In the mid-1980s, he started a specialist culinary herb nursery, Renaissance Herbs, which grew from a single greenhouse into the largest wholesale herb nursery in Australia, cultivating close to a million plants a year. He exited that business in 2005 and purchased a nursery site on the New South Wales Central Coast, where he subsequently founded Distillery Botanica and the Moore's Dry Gin brand. And together with Tom Baker, he co-founded the hugely successful Mr. Black Coffee Liqueur, which we explored with Tom back in Season 8. This is a wide-ranging interview with Philip about his career and the evolution of Australian gin. He certainly doesn't hold back with his opinions on the use of Australian natives by distillers. He shares some tips on how to taste spirits more effectively, and you'll also hear about Philip's new venture, Terrigal Rum Company. That's all coming up in this interview with Distillery Botanica founder, Philip Moore. Philip Moore, thanks so much for joining us on the Drinks Adventures podcast.
Thank you very much for asking me along.
First off, I've got to say congratulations for being inducted into the Gin Magazine Hall of Fame, which I'm sure that's a first for an Australian.
It is, yeah. It really came right out of the blue. You know, there was no consultation with me whatsoever. It was just announced, and I was somewhat flabbergasted, I must say. I mean, the caliber of people who are in the Gin Hall of Fame, like Desmond Payne, he's been distilling for about 40 or 50 years, and then, you know, the chief distiller for Beefeater, and Leslie Gracie from Hendrix, and Joanne Moore from Greenles, who make the Pierre and the Bloom Gin and so on. They're all, you know, masters at their craft. I haven't had to spend 50 years to get there, so I feel quite privileged.
I guess you have been on the radar internationally because with Distillery Botanica, I believe you were one of, if not the first, distilleries to sort of win, gold medals on the world stage out of Australia.
That's right. Well, at the International Wine and Spirit Competition, which I consider is like the Olympic Games for gin, nobody had won a gold medal until 2017, which I got for the Moore's gin. And I had previously, about 8 years before that, got the first silver medal from Australia from the same competition. So after about 500 blends, finally, I got the gold.
What did the distilling landscape look like in Australia when you launched Distillery Botanica?
Well, I think there were about 15 people with distillers' licences, and there were three other gins that I could find at that stage, and they were the sort of gins that if you're going to try them, you really had to know where the latest, you know, ambulance bulletin was going to come from. So they were a little bit how you going. But things have obviously improved out of sight because so many Australian gins have now won awards on international stages.
And you'd recently finished up in your previous profession, which it's quite relevant, isn't it, to the world of botanicals in a gin context?
Yes. Well, I had Australia's largest wholesale herb nursery. We used to grow about a million plants a year at the nursery. So pretty well kept me off the street and concentrating on herbs. And a lot of the herbs that I've been growing were actually used in gin. I mean, with gin, basically you need juniper and you can put just about any other herb in the world in it and it's still called a gin. I've always been very keen on flavours. I've been a very keen home cook, and I used to collect wine. I used to run wine tasting groups and things like that. And so flavour was always very important to me. And I actually wrote a little book about herb flavours and, you know, grouped them into various categories and how those categories then combined with each other. So I'd already done a lot of thinking and tasting, you know, to work out how flavours did work in botanicals, but never, you know, with an eye on making gin.
Now, you're sitting on a property where you've got your own garden there, and tell me about the role that that's played in the gins and the spirits that you've developed at Distillery Botanica.
Well, we do use, you know, like a number of herbs from the garden. Basically, I think you've got to have the best botanicals you can possibly get, and you obviously can't grow all the botanicals in my area because they have, you know, different climatic requirements. So something like juniper, the best ones come from Macedonia and Italy, and in Macedonia it's minus 15 in the wintertime and 35 in the summertime, you know, which is not a climate that we can reproduce on the central coast, you know, just north of Sydney. Some of the herbs like coriander, they need to be really grown on almost like a wheat field of coriander, because if I was going to supply coriander to the distillery, I'd probably need to have, you know, about 2 acres of coriander just growing continuously, which is not, you know, viable when you're concentrating on making spirits.
Tell me about some of the other botanicals that you have growing there and whether you rely upon any of them 100% with the gins that you make.
We have a gin called Roots and Leaves, and we've got ginger and galangal and turmeric and angelica. They're from the garden, and we also have the leaves part of it is all citrus leaves. So we've got mandarin leaf, lemon verbena and curry leaf. We do grow lemon myrtle, which doesn't go into the gin. We make a liqueur.
It's surprising you don't use it in the gin, because it's probably the most popular Australian botanical that gin distillers use. You've got great quality product there and you're not putting it in your gins. Why is that?
Well, every time a prospective gin maker says they're going to put lemon myrtle in their gin, I always cheer, because I know that's one less gin that's really going to be competition for what I'm doing. Because the lemon myrtle works outstandingly well in a liqueur, but it's like a lot of Australian natives in that it has a very harsh aftertaste in a gin, and you can tell it a mile off when it's in there. So the idea behind all of my gins is that they should be absolutely pure and flawless, and I just cannot make a gin flawless by using lemon myrtle. I've also tried the mountain pepperberry, which, you know, people use as well, and I find the same thing. So everything that I do must be able to stand on its own as a spirit. You know, you can't have one sort of substandard spirit coming into a gin, otherwise it just leaves you with that, you know, nagging sort of taste that you think, wow, that's not too good.
So in your view, it's so powerful that even in the most small amounts, it really overpowers any gin.
That's what I feel. I do use some things like the pink peppercorn in the Moore's dry gin. I use that in parts per billion. And it's not just, you know, per billions, many billions. And that comes through, you know, outstandingly well. And, you know, the bottling team we have, none of them are trained in, you know, assessing gins. But when I was developing it, I gave them one without pepper and one with pepper, you know, in parts per billion, and they all said, wow, that's the best one by far. So it's just extraordinary, you know, what the human palate can detect. I mean, there are compounds called thiols, which are in wine and they're also in rum, and they can be detected at 6 parts per billion, you know, quite easily. So you don't, when you've got a very powerful thing like that, you've just really got to cut it down to almost like one molecule per bottle.
You're obviously showing a pretty profound technical understanding of the botanicals that you're working with. How have you developed that over time in distilling? Is that something that's happened gradually?
It has, yeah. Well, you've got to make a start. And sometimes I made starts and they were completely the wrong ones, and then you just keep on trialing, because when I started in gin, there was virtually no formulas you could find for gin, and, you know, very little written about gin. And then, you know, in the last say 10 or so years, there's been, you know, just an absolute plethora of books on gin, which would make it very, very handy. And I discovered, you know, like people like the Difference Guide who go to distilleries, and the distillers seem to tell them everything on how they're actually doing what they're doing. And I'm just wondering whether the Difference Guide, you know, gives them a truth drug or something rather, and then ask some questions, because it's just outstanding, you know, what sort of information you can get from websites, or even websites of, you know, large companies who make all sorts of products. It's just outstanding. You know, the internet is a wonderful thing from that point of view, finding out how to do things.
How difficult was it then, in, you know, your earliest days of distilling, how challenging was it to come up with your original recipes?
Well, I worked on the gin for 6 months and got absolutely nowhere, and I almost gave up, and then I just kept on struggling on. I ended up, at the end of the first year, I'd done 252 different blends, and then I finally thought, yeah, well, that tastes like gin to me. And then I sent it off to London, my very first batch, and they gave it a silver medal. So I thought, I think we're on the right track here.
And what had inspired you in gin previous to that? You know, had you familiarised yourself with some of the classics, and were you a gin enthusiast?
Well, I was actually a wine enthusiast, and then I discovered that I had this food intolerance for MSG and amines, which are in, you know, record levels in wine, so I had to give that away. So then I thought, well, I do like drinking, so I think I'll investigate spirits. And as it turns out, you know, spirits have got, they want, like, especially gin and vodka, they're one of the safest alcohol drinks to drink in the world, you know, because they have very low congeners, like very low high boiling point alcohols and methanol, and they don't have any of the, you know, food intolerances in them whatsoever. So when I used to do the cellar door, I used to get many people coming along and saying that they'd found the same sort of thing, like they could drink gin and they would not have those reactions that they would get from especially wine and, to a lesser extent, beer. So it was just a chemical food intolerance which sort of, you know, drove me towards spirits. Otherwise I might be making wine instead.
The first gin that you made, what was that called, and is that still around now?
It was called Moore's Dry Gin, yeah. So it did have another Australian native in it called the cinnamon myrtle, and then I took that out and put in the pink peppercorn, and that's, by putting in the peppercorn, I got the gold medal. And, you know, like one 200ml bottle of the pink peppercorn is enough to do a whole year's, you know, bottling of Moore's Dry Gin, so it's fairly economical to produce.
And that product has remained pretty consistent ever since?
Well, I'm always fine-tuning. Like I used to get coriander from one particular grower, and then I got another coriander, which it was so powerful I had to cut the coriander down by about 70%, you know, just to get it in balance to give you that Moore's character. And it was a similar thing. I had overseas angelica, and I tracked down some Australian-grown angelica, same thing. I had to reduce it way, way down, about 90%, because there was so much flavour in the Australian angelica. So if I can find really good botanicals, they've got to be the same one, but I will substitute them in there. And if they're really good, I might allow that botanical to have a little bit more influence on the flavour of the gin.
How soon did you start using your own botanicals grown at the property there in your gins?
The first one I made, the only thing that I had in there was the cinnamon myrtle.
Yeah.
Basically, and it was when I did the roots and leaves, and then I've ended up with 8 plants in that. So I'm not really going down the track so much of saying, well, I've grown all this stuff, because as I say, it's got to be like one of the best gins in the world, and if I've got inferior botanicals, there's nothing you can do, you know, by distilling to make them taste better. All you can do is try and cut out. You've got the heads and the hearts and the tails. So the heads is the beginning part of the distillation. The hearts is the middle and the tails is the end. All you can do is just be very, very ruthless on making your cuts to make sure that you don't have any nastiness at the beginning or the end of the distillation, but you can't actually alter the flavour of the botanical, you know, during distillation. Every plant is different. And like some plants we distill in the pot still, some we distill in the vapour infusion baskets, like a steamer basket. Some botanicals we need to macerate and then distill. Some need a long maceration. Some we macerate for 2 weeks. Some might need a maceration of, you know, raise it to 60 degrees and macerate it for 2 hours. So there's all sorts of different ways you can maximise, you know, the potential of each herb. And if you throw them all into a pot together, which is, you know, a conventional way of doing it, you're not going to be maximising those flavours. And the other thing too is that you get different returns with different herbs. So say with juniper, we will get 80% of the alcohol back when we distill it. But if we're distilling the orris root, which is, you know, a popular sort of harmonising sort of herb, you'll probably only get about 45% of that alcohol back. So if you're going to distill the orris and the juniper together, you'll have to stop that distillation when you've got 45% back, because after that, the orris starts to taste very muddy and very fiery, and it has this sort of sweet, pastry, sort of sickly character about it. So that's, and I can taste orris root in a lot of well-known gins. You know, it's just nothing you can do about it. If you're going to get a reasonable return, you have to over-distill the orris root to get that return. And then you're putting in, you know, nasty flavours into it.
Now, you've been judging at the Australian Made Gin Awards for some time now, and I know you're interested in the sensory side of appraising gins. What have you learnt about tasting and glassware and how to taste most effectively?
Well, I think just going back to, you know, the Gin Awards, I think they are very important for people to learn, you know, how their gins, you know, rate in the world. And they say back in the 70s and 80s, that's why the Australian wine industry became what it was, because they had a lot of competitions and a lot of, you know, collegiate sort of judging of each other's wines so that they could then improve them. But unless you get some opinion, you know, you're never going to improve the quality. And I've tasted, like probably the majority of the gins that I've tasted in competitions really, in my opinion, shouldn't be in bottles. And that's where, you know, tasting is very, very important. Like the people making these gins, they have either not developed their palate, or they've just decided, well, that's the best we can do. Let's put it in a bottle and see if somebody will buy it. But the only problem with that approach is people buy one bottle of it and never buy another one. And so I think it's really important for everybody in any, you know, line of, you know, alcohol beverage production to do the very best they can, you know, to train their palate. That would lead to an increase in quality of, you know, all Australian spirits.
What are the most common faults that you see in these gins?
Well, I think one of the major problems is that botanicals that come from the Northern Hemisphere, like there's been farming going on for 10,000 years in the Northern Hemisphere, and the first person to, you know, discover a peach, it might have been the size of a marble and tasted really foul, and then over a period of time, you know, they would observe that the peaches from this tree tasted very nice, so then they would select that out. And then that constant selection over thousands of years, you end up with a peach, you know, that's the size of a cricket ball. It's juicy and has, you know, lovely flavours. But unfortunately, with the Australian natives, that process hasn't happened. There has been like a little bit of breeding, but not much. And the thing is with Australian natives, you put them in a gin, the entry, as it enters your palate, can be quite okay, but then the aftertaste invariably is just absolutely bitter and unpalatable. So I made a gin for another company, Garden Grown Gin, and it was made using plants from the Mount Tomar Botanic, the Mount Annan Botanic Garden near Campbelltown, south of Sydney. And myself and the director walked around the garden for a couple of hours, tasted all these plants. I brought back 26 to the distillery. I distilled them all individually, and there was only two that I could use, you know, to make this gin. Because the rest of them, quite often you can taste something, but when you distill it, because you've got it under heat and you've got alcohol and you're extracting all the flavour, you suddenly extract these flavours that you didn't anticipate from just, you know, sniffing the leaf or chewing on it. And so basically I think that we need, you know, like to have a breeding program for Australian natives for them to be used widely, because, you know, I can just tell it a mile off that has got Australian natives in, because it's got this particular characteristic, because a lot of the Australian natives have cineol, which is a major ingredient in eucalyptus oil. And cineol Like if you use that in parts per billion, it's quite nice. But if you use that at a regular dose, it just makes the most, you know, unpalatable sort of gin you can think of. So my way of using Australian natives is that, say if you've got the bunion up, you put some bunion nuts in your hand and then you climb up on top of the bottling tank, open the hatch, and then you just say into the tank, bunion nut, and then you throw the bunion nuts in the bin. And that's the best way to use bunion nuts.
It's a very contrarian view because there is a lot of excitement in Australian distilling at the moment around natives, and a lot of distillers are really rushing to embrace a lot of these natives.
Mm. Well, as I say, at their peril, you know, because you've got to have, you know, very, very tight cuts, you know, your heads and your tails, you've got to be totally ruthless, and you will then be cutting down your yield quite a lot. And that's why I think if you're going to do Australian natives, you've really got to distill them individually so you can have those tight cuts, because otherwise you're going to end up losing, you know, half the volume of your distillation because you've had to cut it too early in order to keep, you know, some sort of palatable flavour from the Australian natives. I've got a few things on tasting that I think are worthwhile, you know, thinking about it if you're just a consumer or, you know, if you're somebody who gets together with some people and tastes things. And one of them is the room is incredibly important. So you want to be in a room that's really soundproof, because it's amazing, you know, the effect that sound has on the palate. Really, tastings have got to be done in complete silence, you know, in a soundproof room if you're going to get, you know, really serious about it, I think. I mean, I wasn't able to do it at the distillery because we have so much noise going on there, and especially with the production of Mr. Black, which, you know, just going like a rat up a drainpipe in sales all over the place. And so I used to have to walk outside to a quiet place, you know, on the property where there was no distraction in order to do my tasting. It makes a very big difference. You then need to consider your glassware. And we did an exercise at the distillery. We bought 9 glasses, which, you know, theoretically should be okay for tasting spirits. And I don't have any shareholdings in this company, but I would really like to push this glass because we've done so many tests. We've tried all the Riedel range, you know, many different ranges of glasses. And the best one is from a company in Melbourne called Plum, PLUMM. And it's basically a red wine Shiraz glass, and it's called the Red B Plus. It's got a huge bowl and it's shaped like a thistle, so it constricts at the top. But at the top, it's got quite a big aperture at the top there, and you get this huge headspace. So you're getting a large volume of you know, vapor coming off the spirit. And a guy who imports, you know, quite a bit of rum to Australia, he gave me a tasting, but I used the 2 glasses, you know, this Scottish one and the Plum. You know, he was just about fell off his chair, couldn't believe, you know, what he was getting out of, you know, the glass that I recommend. It's just, it's something that they cost about $15 each, so I suppose they're not cheap, but if you compare it to Riedel, which can cost, you know, 40, 50, 60 bucks, they're pretty good. I mean, it's really a worthwhile investment, you know, in the success of anybody if they want to, you know, taste spirits. Another thing I find intriguing is that our nostrils are different. Like on one day, your left nostril will determine, you know, flavour is much better or aroma is much better than your right nostril, and then the next day it can switch around. So you need to every day just find out which nostril it is that's working best and then sort of angle, you know, the glass towards that. The thing that I think is probably most important in tasting is to give yourself enough time between each taste for your palate to try and go back to where it was before, because when you're tasting spirits, they're a lot more intense than, say, tasting wine or beer. And the thing is with bitters, like if you taste sweet and acid, they're almost instantly, you know, discernible on the palate. But if you taste bitter, it can take sometimes up to 30 seconds for it to appear on your palate. And so if you've already gone on to the next glass alongside straight away, that, you know, and if the bitter's taking 30 seconds to come in, you're then thinking that second glass is very, very bitter, but it was actually the first one. And so it's just very, very important to really, you know, give yourself a couple of minutes, especially with spirits, because your palate will get exhausted, you know, very quickly if you're just going boom, 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 tasting like that.
You mentioned in passing, Mr. Black, coffee liqueur there. We've had Tom Baker on the show previously. Now, that's turned into a bit of a powerhouse of a product, hasn't it? Tell me about how you, from your perspective, how you joined up with Tom and founded that.
Well, I made a coffee liqueur, and once again, I sent it off to the IWSC, and they kindly gave me a gold medal for the very first batch that I made. And Tom originally approached me to make a gin, but unfortunately I already had a contract with somebody else, which sort of excluded me from making any other gins. But if I hadn't have, maybe, you know, Tom would have turned this a gin like into a world beater as well. But it's just absolutely selling its head off in the United States at the moment. And we've had to move Mr. Black into a completely new facility with, you know, much more high-powered equipment in order to be able to, you know, produce it at the level that's required. So it's been, you know, a very good – Tom's, you know, very good in the marketing side, and then I'm obviously okay at making, you know, gold medal award-winning drinks. And so between the two of us, we've, you know, managed to put like a – well, I know – Tom always says it's the best coffee liqueur in the world, and I haven't seen anything to contradict that. So it just is outstanding. And I always say, you know, we've been very eccentric with our coffee liqueur because we're actually using coffee beans to make a coffee liqueur. Whoever would have thought of doing that? You know, when you can just go to, you know, a flavour house and go and buy some flavour, because we went to see these guys who are experts, and they said, oh, yeah, we could make a coffee liqueur in 3 hours. And I said, how do you do that? Said, well, we just buy some flavouring and we put in some alcohol and some sugar, and we've got a coffee liqueur, and that's what they do. So we're just, you know, breaking the mould by actually using real coffee beans to make a real coffee liqueur.
And, you know, what's the guiding principles of what Distillery Botanica makes? Are you going to stick to sort of gins and liqueurs? Where do you draw the lines on the sorts of products that you're going to release under that label?
Well, yeah, on that label, but I've done a couple of years of research on rum. I've done something like 138 different fermentations and distillations in a trial still, and basically, instead of using distiller's yeasts, which in the main they're produced to make very good, like to make spirit, but not to make flavour, and so I've discovered there's quite a few distilleries around, they're actually using wine yeast to make the flavour in rum. So I've developed a whole range of yeasts. Well, I haven't developed the yeast, but I've used a whole range of yeasts, which I can get, you know, if I want, I can have a passion fruit flavour, I can have a pineapple flavour, I can have a dried fruit flavour, I can have a citrus flavour, merely from using the appropriate yeast. So it means you can basically construct any blend you like just by having a number of yeasts. Probably pretty much the same as, you know, the Four Roses bourbon. They use five different yeasts. They have a floral yeast, a herbal yeast, a spice yeast, and two fruity yeasts. And that's how they get, you know, their flavours. So I'm just really sort of following along what they've pioneered.
And what will that be branded as, that product?
Well, that's going to be branded as the Terrigal Rum Company.
Ah, okay. And so you've got capacity there and barrels and so forth to do some maturation as well?
Well, the capacity will be coming fairly soon. We have like a still four times larger than one we've got, and we've already done some 2,000-litre fermentation trials, and so all we're waiting for now is the equipment and the actual liquid. I think I can produce, if I can reproduce it in the larger still, will be, I mean, I know I would say that, but it is going to be outstanding.
You must have tried a bunch of commercially available rums on the market. Where are you hoping that it's going to sit? Like, what sort of flavour profile are you looking for? And what are you distilling? Is it a molasses base, or is it an agricole product?
It's molasses, and it's from northern New South Wales, from the Clarence River Valley. And basically, I personally don't like rum agricoles. I mean, I think by definition they have to have that sort of grassy bitter flavour in it, and the grassy bitter flavour is one that, I mean, you also get the grassy bitter flavour with the molasses, but I've worked out a way of using yeasts which actually cancel out that sort of grassy bitter flavour. Like if you take something like Foursquare or the Dawley's range, you know, R.L. Seal range, they don't have any of that in. The same with if you take, the Exo Mount Gay rum too. I mean, that impeccably clean, but absolutely jam-packed full of flavour. There's a guy in Scotland who reviews rums whiskey and rums called Ralphie, and he says that the Mount Gay is a masterclass in how to produce a rum, and I agree. It is just a magnificent thing. And I mean, there's also like, well, they're obviously from Barbados, you know, Foursquare and Mount Gay, but the Jamaican rums do have that little bit of funkiness in. But I mean, something like Hampden Estate, they've got that grassy character in, but it's in almost a perfect balance with all the rest of the, you know, the tropical flavours and the spices and so on that you get in the rum. And so you end up with something, I think, with that Hampden Estate, you could almost, you know, put it into a whiskey lineup and people would think, oh, that's an unusual whiskey, but it is definitely a whiskey, you know. So there's all sorts of things you can do, you know, by using, you know, that's what they're relying on in Jamaica, the bacteria, which is also another road that I've gone down as well. I've found a paper on the bacteria that occur naturally in rum distilleries in the Caribbean, and so I've tracked these bacteria down, but they're in very pure form, so they're not going to, you know, create bad fermentation. So you put them in together with, you know, some wine yeast and you've suddenly got, you know, like a very classic tropical, you know, pineapple, passion fruit, banana flavoured rum.
And, you know, rum's obviously a bit out of fashion. Premium rum is a bit out of fashion in Australia. Obviously, you know, rum's a popular spirit in Australia generally, but are you confident that you can, you know, turn more Australians on to rum?
Well, last year in the UK, rum sales were up 30%. I don't know on what base, but there seems to be a lot more rums, you know, becoming available in the high class rums. And so I'm hoping that basically, you know, we've got the building block of, you know, Bundaberg, you know, they have the largest rum sales in the country, that, you know, we can sort of build on that and introduce like a much bigger choice of rums. I think because when I started making gin, there was probably 6 gins that were regularly available in most bottle shops. And now there's, you know, like you go into some of the larger chain stores and there's like 3 bays just jam-packed full of gins. And I think that's what makes it interesting, whereas if you've got 6 lines, then it's not very interesting because you soon run out of, you know, new things to try. So if we can start introducing our high-quality Australian rums, then it then can become like a collector's item, I think, and probably like whiskey with so many different whiskey, you know, people in Australia now.
Well, Philip, we've covered a lot of territory. It's been a really interesting chat. Thanks so much for your time and joining us on the show, and congratulations again on becoming a Gin Magazine Hall of Famer.
Thank you very much, James. Yeah, I really enjoyed the chat, so thanks again.
The Drinks Adventures podcast is produced by me, James Atkinson, with additional production and mixing by Dave Robertson. You can find complete transcripts, links, and other information on the show at drinksadventures.com.au. You can follow me on all social media platforms at By James Atkinson, like my Facebook page, James Atkinson Drinks Adventures, to be kept informed of podcast giveaways and other news about the show. The Drinks Adventures podcast needs your support as listeners. Please do us a favour and leave an honest review and rating for the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. We love hearing your feedback, and it helps inform other people this is a show worth listening to. Or simply drop us a line at hello@drinksadventures.com.au.